Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of The Damage Report. I am John Adirola. We've got a big show for you with some of my favorite recurring guests, friends of the show, joining us once again to break down the latest in the news. Not only are we going to have, you know, stuff with the Green New Deal, ongoing negotiations about a possible government shutdown and attempts to avert it. It looks like we might actually have a deal, maybe, but I'll be breaking down the details of that. We also have Ro Khanna, representative, who's going to be joining us once again to break down his latest efforts to pull the U.S. out of involvement in the war in Yemen. We're also going to be talking about the Green New Deal, a bill that he not only supports but also has co-sponsored. So very exciting stuff there. And in our ongoing coverage of the money behind a number of these candidates for the Democratic nomination for the presidency, we're once again having Ashley Balcerzak back on the show from the Center for Public Integrity. And she has been diving into the donors for Senator Amy Klobuchar, who just recently announced that she will be pursuing that nomination. We've previously done videos on Senators Booker and Gillibrand. Now we'll have Klobuchar. There's a lot to get through, but she's up to the task, and she'll be joining us in the latter half of the show to do just that. At the end of the show, assuming we have time, one of my favorite things to do, take a little tour around the world of news as put together by our awesome producers here at The Damage Report. Meanwhile, in news from around the world, actually news from around the Imperium, fans of Warhammer are going to want to stick around for a little bit of news involving Trump as well. But we're starting off with the environment. Donald Trump had his big El Paso speech yesterday, and while much of it was focused on immigration, his efforts to get the wall, and all of that, he also made time to spread some actual, absolute BS about the Green New Deal. Now, in this particular case, I don't even really blame Donald Trump because he doesn't know anything about the environment. He doesn't really know anything about the actual elements of the Green New Deal. He's been consuming a lot of Fox News, and Fox News has lost their mind about this plan, as we'll show you in just a little bit. But you can see how much he's absorbed of their talking points against the Green New Deal in quotes like this. So Philip Rucker tweeted from Trump's speech, "I really don't like their policy of taking away your car, of taking away your airplane rights, of let's hop a train to California, of you're not allowed to own cows anymore." This is a guy struggling to talk. But let's break down the individual things that he said there, because many of these are things that you've heard from other right-wing pundits and politicians about the Green New Deal. So the policy of taking away your car, it's not in the proposal. It's not been talked about around the proposal. They talk about incentivizing and subsidizing cars that will be cleaner. That's true. I have never heard AOC say, "I'm going to snatch your Plymouth out from under you." That's not a part of the plan at all. Just a lie. Of taking away your airplane rights, well, you might be shocked to find out that you have rights when it comes to airplanes. I didn't think that we had rights. I thought that the only right we had was to pay an ever-increasing amount for ever-shrinking seats. But there is concern about the emissions of planes, that's true. And once again, they do want to reduce the total amount of air travel, but not by taking away planes, not by banning you from flying, but by incentivizing the government construction of high-speed rail lines and other things like that, making it so that you don't have to fly to travel. All of these options, when it comes to cars, when it comes to mass transit, they're going to be providing a cleaner and in many cases better mode of travel and making it cheaper for you to use that. They're not going to be forcing you to do anything or not to do anything, but the right has to fearmonger in that way to scare you away from pursuing something like the Green New Deal. So, of let's hop a train to California, I don't even know what that means. There are trains that go to California, that's true. There might be more in the future, I don't know what he means there. Of you're not allowed to own cows anymore. So in one of the FAQs around the Green New Deal, so this isn't even a part of the proposal, let alone the legislation that will eventually come that will lay out the specifics that will make the Green New Deal an actual thing that affects the environment and the economy. They talked about how one of the reasons they are calling for net zero emissions within a certain time frame rather than zero emissions in a certain time frame is because it's more realistic. But more specifically, it's because they think that when you look at some of the contributors to carbon emissions and environmental toxins, things like that, there are some things that just can't be wound down in 10 years, no matter how much you subsidize them. So they're being realistic. And some of the examples they give are, we know people are going to continue to fly planes, which goes against their point that they're going to ban air travel, and also that cows fart and emit methane. Okay, that is both a truth that got a cheer from the control room. That is both a truth and also, in the context of that FAQ, kind of a joke. Because yes, industrialized agriculture, the huge quantities of cows and stuff that we have, they do produce a lot of methane from farts. But talking about emissions in terms of farts is a funny way of doing it. That is what they were doing. They're not going to take away cows. They're not going to ban cows. I don't even know what that would be. But this is the level of intellectual honesty with which the right is apparently ready to engage with those pushing for the Green New Deal. I've been sarcastically tweeting about this. It would be great if we had environmentalists, people like AOC and others who want to do something about climate change, and they're like, here's our proposal. And then the right says, well, you know what? I've talked to a lot of scientists, and they really think that a better way to lower emissions is X. But we're not going to have that debate. Maybe someday, maybe when they've lost a number of different elections because they become so detached from reality that they have no chance, then they will come back with a plan. They don't have that now. Instead, they have, last week, they introduced a massive government takeover that would destroy our incredible economic gains. They introduced the so-called Green New Deal. It sounds like a high school term paper that got a low mark. So it's not a so-called Green New Deal. That's just what it's called. That's how names work. Okay? So it's called the Green New Deal. It's not so-called. But again, then at the end, Donald Trump says, it sounds like a high school term paper that got a low mark. So why is he saying that? He's saying that because although he does not like to use Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's name out loud, he fears that he will make her more popular by exposing her extremely popular ideas to his base. He does want to attack her. And he chose to do it the way that they always do since AOC became a national figure. It's not that they can actually argue against her policies on the merits. We've already shown you they're not going to do that. But they do want you to think, is she really serious? Looks kind of crazy, kind of dances in videos, and also she's so young. She's so young, it's like a high schooler. And that is why on Fox News you've seen multiple people say, this seems like something a teenager would do. This is high school work. That is the thing they're going to use to try to take her down. I got news for you. People in general, in America, across the world, humans, we kind of like youth. Youth is kind of a good thing. We kind of like long for our own lost youth. I know I'm doing that every day now. So I'm not sure that that's actually going to work for them. And although he chose not to use her name, it was not lost on Representative Ocasio-Cortez that he was targeting her. And so she responded, yes, a man who can't even read briefings written in full sentences is providing literary criticism of a House resolution. And then she quotes a Washington Post article about his intelligence briefing saying, reading the intelligence book is not Trump's preferred style of learning. We are still looking for that style of learning. We've not been able to identify it just yet. So again, look, she wants to engage in a debate on the actual policies that will underlie the Green New Deal. And she understands that even in advance of that, there is a lot of call across the country, both from the left and from the center and from the right, to do something about this. Her proposal is already wildly popular. It's one of the reasons that virtually all, but not all, unfortunately, of those who are going to be running in the Democratic primary this time around have already endorsed the Green New Deal. So expect to see more of it. And I just want to briefly say, it's not just Donald Trump, and it's not just Fox News. Take a look at a tweet from Politico about what the right-wing arguments are on the Green New Deal. Republicans bashed the concept of the Green New Deal as technologically impossible, unimaginably costly, and a socialist fever dream that they said would cost Democrats moderate seats across the country. Now, I think the person who wrote that tweet for Politico, they don't necessarily think that they're doing propaganda for the right or for the Republican Party. And they would probably say, well, Republicans are saying that stuff. And that's true. So the socialist fever dream, I'm sure that's a direct quote. Saying it's unimaginably costly, they didn't put that in quotation marks. That is, at best, a summarization of what the right would say. And in sum, when you put those three arguments all in one tweet there, if you were, you know, a spokesperson for the National Republican Congressional, you know, Campaign Committee or something like that, could you have dreamed of a better quote for your side than that? I don't know the individual writer. I don't know what their politics are. I don't know what their stance is on the Green New Deal. But you can expect that going forward, there is going to be, at best, sort of an insulting portrayal of the people pushing for the Green New Deal, saying that they're unrealistic, they don't understand money, they're too young and stuff like that. And then there are going to be people like carrying water for the Republican Party. And so outlets like Politico and others, they're going to frame things as, here is what the responsible adults in the room believe, and here is what these wild-eyed dreamers believe. And you know, it's kind of cute that they want to stop climate change, but do they really understand how the economy works? We'll go into more of that sort of framing later on. For now, we do have to take a break. But when we come back, Representative Ro Khanna is going to be joining us for the latest on the war in Yemen and the U.S.'s future involvement in that.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom, In each episode of Un*** the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
This. Just a few months ago, we came so close to pulling the U.S. out of involvement in Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen. And unfortunately, the Republican-controlled House was able to stop that. A lot has changed since then. And so I'm very happy to welcome to the show one of the representatives who are leading the charge to finally finish that path. That is Representative Ro Khanna. Ro, welcome back to the show.
John, thanks for having me on. It's always one of my favorite shows to do.
Thank you so much. I feel the same way about you being on, not about me doing it. Although I do like that too. We're once again talking about Yemen, really hoping that we can finish this thing. You're going to be putting forward your bill once again. What does that bill aim to do?
Well, the bill is very simple. It says that the United States was never authorized by Congress to be involved in aiding the Saudi coalition in the horrific bombing in Yemen. We need to stop any support for the Saudi coalition bombing. That means no refueling of their planes, no sharing intelligence, no assisting with logistics. There are 14 million Yemenis that face the possibility of famine. This is because the Saudi coalition has been bombing the ports and not letting food and medicine in. When this resolution passes the House and when it passes the Senate, it will be a huge signal to the Saudis that they need to come to the peace table, stop the bombing, and let humanitarian aid in.
And it certainly seems like that should be the outcome. It's previously passed the Senate. And unless strategically some Republicans were voting in favor of it, knowing that the House would shoot it down, it seems like now it'll pass the House, it'll pass the Senate, it'll go to Donald Trump. What do you think the chances are that Donald Trump will acknowledge, you know, I guess the political wins and go along with that? Or might he fight it and stick with his allies in Saudi Arabia?
Well, John, there are two possible outcomes. One, you believe it or not, Lindsey Graham was quoted in Politico saying he may actually consider voting for the resolution. Now, if you have people like Lindsey Graham come in and support the resolution, that's going to create a broad coalition and put a lot of pressure on the president to possibly sign it. I know it's an uphill fight, but the president's calling for withdrawal in Afghanistan. He's calling for withdrawal in Syria. It would be hypocritical for him to then say, yeah, but we need to have our involvement in Yemen. Second, even if the president doesn't sign it, it's still going to have an extraordinary impact. In the history of this country, since 1973, when the War Powers Resolution was passed, in our entire history, there has never been a War Powers Resolution that has passed both the House and the Senate. Kucinich and McGovern, many of them, they used to introduce these. These used to get 5-10 votes. This is a testament to people, your viewership, the Young Turks, to folks around this country mobilizing, saying, put an end to endless wars. So this is a huge statement, and we know that it's going to have an impact on the Saudis coming to the peace table. We know last year when the Senate passed it, Mattis called up the coalition and said, you're embarrassing us, come to the peace table, and that led in part to the temporary ceasefire. So I think a statement where both House and Senate pass it would have an extraordinary effect on the peace negotiations themselves.
And I have to say that as a, you know, a former poli-sci student, actually having the War Powers Act being talked about at all at the national level is certainly novel. And I'm curious, now that you have, as you point out, on Yemen, you have so many willing to finally assert their constitutionally delegated role in this process, do you think that if in the future, if in the next 2 years, Donald Trump, who has at various points made very threatening remarks about North Korea, Iran, Venezuela, if he does look like he wants to initiate some sort of military action against these states, do you think that some of your allies on this issue with Yemen might be emboldened to stand up to him in those cases as well?
Well, that's exactly the point, John. This is a shot across the bow from Congress to the executive branch saying, think twice before you get us into another military excursion overseas, whether it's Iran or Venezuela or North Korea. The Congress is not going to stay silent. The Supreme Court has said that they defer to the executive branch because Congress stays silent. But if Congress asserts our role, that's going to make the executive branch a lot more wary about just getting into war. So I do think there is an emerging left-right coalition that is wary of military interventionism, that looks at Iraq, that looks at Libya, that looks at Syria, and says that the military interventionism has often made bad situations worse and has not made us safer, and that we need to be far more judicious before using military force overseas, especially when there is not a direct threat to our national security.
And it's possible that, you know, timing-wise, as you're initiating this conversation, things are being rethought that have just been sort of accepted for some time in D.C., you have the beginnings of the 2020 Democratic primary. And I wonder, do you believe that this sort of re-questioning of some of the orthodoxy on foreign policy in the Democratic Party, will that be a sort of vocal part of this primary process, do you think?
I do. I mean, I think this is going to be a huge win, of course, for Senator Sanders to say that he helped literally stop a war in Yemen because of his efforts in partnership with some of us in the House. I also think Elizabeth Warren is working towards helping reorient foreign policy. She has said that she supports troop withdrawal from Afghanistan and Syria. So I think that the fault lines on foreign policy is going to be a huge issue in the primary. People say, oh, foreign policy, people don't vote on foreign policy. That's not true. They may not care about intricacies of diplomacy, but they care about matters of war and peace. They want to end the endless wars. They want to invest in projects back home. And that's a message I think you'll hear from Democratic candidates on the field.
I hope so. And I was also hoping to get your thoughts on the launch within just the last week of the initial proposal around the Green New Deal. There's been a lot of enthusiasm from environmental progressives on that. The right appears to have collectively lost their mind and are fighting against some fictional fantasy version of the proposal that doesn't exist. What do you think about the Constitution, the conversation that's been generated by the launch of the Green New Deal over the past week?
Well, it's long overdue. It's urgent. But here's what I tell my Republican friends. I said, okay, let's agree to disagree on scientific facts on climate change. Do you want us to lose our environmental job creation leadership to China? Because China is doing this. They're creating the solar jobs. They're creating the wind jobs. They're creating energy efficiency jobs. Would you rather those jobs and industry be in China, or would you rather we lead there? This is a policy that is pro-economic growth. It's going to put people at GM and other people at factories back to work as you have SUV electric vehicles. It's going to create jobs in solar and wind. So this is good for the economy and it's future oriented. The Republicans are opposing something that's actually in our national interest.
Yep. I just have to say that gives me hope, because when I hear from the right, they're saying Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez wants to ban cows. That sort of response coming from you right there, I think, is going to be pretty convincing to the American people. And hopefully you'll be given the right venues to make that argument.
Well, I just think it's ridiculous. I mean, they're appealing to a fear and they're throwing these things out. I think what we've got to say is we're forward looking and we care about the American interest and competitiveness. I can make this argument from Silicon Valley. We lost the semiconductor industry to Taiwan because we weren't ahead of the curve in realizing the technology. On the other hand, we didn't lose some of the software companies. Apple and Google and others are still here. Well, we want to make sure that the clean tech economy, which is going to be a huge part of the world economy, is in the United States. I don't see how any American would be opposed to that. And that's really what the Green New Deal is about.
Representative Rokana, as always, thank you for joining us. Appreciate your input.
Thank you, John.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, a possible deal to avert a government shutdown and a reporter attacked at a Trump rally. All that and more after this. So ever since the last shutdown, we have been anticipating the beginning of the next one. That's why we've had this little counter going on there. But maybe we won't have one. As of last night, congressional negotiators are saying that they have reached, in principle, a deal to avert a government shutdown. And as you're going to see, it is definitely the product of bipartisan negotiations because nobody likes it. So here are some of the details. A Democratic congressional aide told the Daily News that the committee had agreed to tuck away $1.375 billion for the construction of 55 miles of bollard fencing. No wall, said the aide, while reducing the number of detention beds at the disposal of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency by 17.4% from about 49,000 to about 40,000. So let's start there. Those are the two big things. There's also some extra money for border security not having to do with any sort of barriers, but the beds are the new thing as of the last week. The idea was if you could drastically reduce the number of beds, then you can refocus ICE away from just mass capturing huge quantities of people, including complete non-criminal offenses and all of that, and holding them for long periods of time and refocus ICE on actually tracking down people who've committed serious crimes. So initially, they wanted to get that number down to something like 16 to 18,000. It looks like they were not successful in that, which this will be the running theme throughout this, which seems odd considering they completely won the last battle in this, which was the first shutdown of this year. But okay, they failed on getting down the beds more than they were able to here. Also, 55 miles of bollard fencing. Now, the aide immediately shouts, no wall. I don't understand what the significant difference is between bollard fencing and a wall. They specifically say in the deal, thank you for the bollard fencing there. You know what that bollard fencing looks like? It looks like a wall. I mean, kind of see-through, I guess. So technically, if you put two of them, you know, sort of offset a bit, it'd be an actual wall. So good, it's a half wall. That's wonderful. There's no concrete walls. It's still a wall, though. I mean, at the end of the day, a fence is kind of like a wall, and this is much more wallish than fence-ish, considering that you can't just, you know, like move past, you can't shake through it or anything. This looks pretty serious. And so coming out of it, they're going to say, we were successful. There's no wall. But any reasonable person, I think, looks at this and says, well, it looks like there's 55 miles of wall, okay? Now, this is double the amount allocated in the last spending agreement, but 10 miles less than the bipartisan Senate Homeland Security funding bill from 2018 that Trump rejected. And that graphic right there, that is Congress in four lines. Because what we have is there's going to be more wall built than in the past go around, which would imply that the people who are fighting against a wall must have failed because now there's going to be more wall. But they didn't fail. In the last shutdown, Donald Trump blinked because his approval rating was tanking. If anything, there should be progress in that area, but there's not. On the other side, though, Donald Trump, if he accepts this, will get less wall than he would have if we had never launched in this entire thing at all. If back in December he had just agreed to the bipartisan deal that was agreed to, he would have slightly more wall. Now, in the grand scheme of things, 55 miles or 65 miles out of a possible couple thousand miles on the U.S. southern border is not significant, but it is still more wall. And it helps him to continue his narrative that this is necessary. Look, Republicans and Democrats have agreed to this. I guess we were right. And if they agreed to 55, the next year, why not 100? Why not 200? Why not 500? After all, we obviously all agree that walls are necessary. And that aide who shouts no wall, just fencing, we'll see how that argument goes going forward. I'm sure Donald Trump will be very nuanced about the terminology there. He calls it a wall, he calls it concrete, he calls it fencing, he calls it, peaches, I think at one point. Okay, whatever he needs to call it, he will. And if it's peaches that advances his narrative going into 2020, that is what he's going to use. And this deal, as written, seems to help him out in that regard. So in terms of whether he likes this deal or not, I'm going to jump ahead a little bit. He talked about it at the rally last night and said, I don't even want to hear about it. I don't want to hear about it. So I don't know what they mean. Progress is being made. I think he's being very literal right there. There are words in the phrase progress is being made that he does not know the definition of. But supposedly he's against the deal. I do know that the informal vice president of the United States, Sean Hannity, said $1.3 billion? That's not even a wall, a barrier? I'm going to tell this tonight, and we will get back into this tomorrow. Any Republican that supports this garbage compromise, you will have to explain. Okay, the fact that he doesn't like the deal makes me slightly more positive towards it, but I understand that what he's pushing for there is much, much, much more funding. I'm sure he accepts that this is progress, that he is getting wall capitalized. But they, of course, want more than that. Now, what the question is going to be, I think, going into today is, later on today, Donald Trump is going to watch Sean Hannity. Sean Hannity is going to tell him to reject the deal. But hours and hours before he hits Sean Hannity, he's going to have to make his way through a whole big field of Ducey, and he's going to see stuff like this.
The $1.375 billion, a lot less than 5.7. However, you get 55 miles. It's taken them a year and a half just to start on 2017. Not that they're lazy, but because contracts have to be handed out, equipment's got to be acquired, and they got to get the plans. So they're starting week from 2017.
So, I mean, look, I guess compared to people like Sean Hannity, right there, what you saw was Fox and Friends being a little bit more reasonable. But every bit of that about the not wanting to say that they're being lazy and praising the fact that they made a few miles last year, all of that is just the verbal cable news equivalent of lightly stroking the president's head. Just like, you're a good boy, you're doing great things, you're gonna love this deal. And the thing is, honestly, that could be the defining thing right there that causes him to take this deal rather than deny it. I mean, look, as a person who doesn't want to see any wall built and doesn't like the idea that we need a wall being a narrative that has any supporting evidence, even if it's BS evidence like this with the Ballard fencing, I would prefer them to just not accept this deal. If he wants to launch into another 2 or 5 or 10 days of a shutdown that is going to hurt him and his party, then go right ahead with that, is how I would say. But I think, as much as he says he wants real wall, he's supported bollard fencing before. Is there any reason to believe that he won't take this and say this is a victory? I think that that might be the way that this ends up going. Now, I do want to turn to other stuff that happened at the event last night. We turn now to video, live video, BBC reporter, first person account of being attacked by a Trump supporter, as you'll see.
Americans, Hispanic Americans, and Asian Americans have reached the lowest level in the history of our country.
Okay, so what you saw there was a video of Donald Trump's face. The reason it went crazy is because someone knocked into, from behind, the BBC reporter, Ron Skeens, who had been filming Donald Trump. One of the Trump supporters there, you can see him in his MAGA hat. He attacks this guy from behind, real bold, alpha male right there, and then begins shouting, you know, that he's in favor of Trump and all that. Sort of sickeningly, the crowd responds to a reporter from the BBC being attacked by shouting, CNN sucks. It wasn't a CNN reporter. It would be awful if it was, but it wasn't even a CNN reporter. They don't understand that. Most don't even know what BBC actually is. So there you have a reporter being attacked once again at that rally. You will be shocked to find out that Donald Trump had been demonizing the media as he has been doing for literally years. Thankfully, the guy just violently shoved him. He didn't punch him in the face. He didn't have a weapon or anything like that. God only knows what would have happened if he did. But it is interesting to see how Donald Trump reacts to this. So we didn't see his face in the second half of that video because the camera was being knocked around. But Donald Trump did have to acknowledge that one of his supporters attacked a reporter after he was demonizing the media. And here's how he handled it.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. You all right? Everything okay? Please? Okay, thank you. Thank you. And women have.
And he goes right back into his message. So I guess he asked if the guy was okay. That's surprising. But what you saw there, if you weren't watching the live feed, you didn't see it. I don't know if anyone watching this used to watch The Office back in the original UK version. But his like weird, creepy look and point was so David Brent to me. Like a guy who feels no responsibility for what's going on there. Like, this guy had been, like, he doesn't know exactly what happened. For all he knows, at that point, the BBC reporter had stabbed him. And he feels no responsibility. What you could have done, what most politicians, I think, would have done, certainly Barack Obama might have done, John McCain had a similar moment back during his campaign and did, maybe instead of launching back into your end women talking point, you could have said something about not physically assaulting members of the press. That would have been a great moment for that, that was opened up to you by the fact that one of your guys who was so enthused about what you were saying about the media sucking and being fake news that he felt he had to attack someone from behind. He could have done that. He chose not to do that. Instead, the campaign puts out a statement saying that the attacker was probably drunk. Well, good. Then we probably shouldn't have to worry about that anymore because God knows Trump supporters probably don't drink. Here's the thing. There are drunks out there. There are crazy people out there. Some of them pay attention to politics. Some of them like any individual politician. Maybe be a little bit more careful about the way that you go out of your way day after day to demonize members of the press, even after members of the press have been gunned down in our country, after pipe bombs have been sent to all of your political opponents. Maybe tone it down a little bit after multiple deaths so that we can avoid ones in the future. With that said, we are going to take a break. We come back. Senator Amy Klobuchar has announced her run in the Democratic primary. But what is the money that is backing her up? We're breaking that down after this. So when it comes to political candidates for president, you can learn a lot from what they say, what they advocate for, but sometimes you can learn even more from the money that got them into office in the first place. And for that reason, we've been breaking down the financing and donors of all of the candidates that we can for this Democratic primary nomination fight that we are launching into. And the person who's been doing that for us, Ashley Balcerzak, Center for Public Integrity. Ashley, welcome back to the Damage Report.
Thanks so much for having me.
Always glad to have you here. And now we're talking about Senator Amy Klobuchar. And I know that in her past few elections, she has won very decisive victories. When it comes to fundraising, has she been equally successful?
Yes, she has. Well, I guess it depends on what you're looking at. So she outraised her Republican opponent by 38 times, I believe. But
okay, that's a big lead.
Yeah, but then compared to the average senator, she's actually raised quite less. I think she raised $10 million over the last 6 years, and the average Senate candidate during that time was $16 million. So that's kind of a difference in that sense. So she was really good for Minnesota, but nationally, she's a bit lower.
Okay, so that gives us some of an idea of how she might do in raising money for a national bid. When it comes to money on hand that she's previously raised and like personal wealth that she might be able to draw on to aid in her run for the presidency, how does she compare to some of the other candidates?
Yeah, so she has $3.9 million on hand, which it's about in the middle, like compared to Elizabeth Warren, who has, I think, $11 million, quite much less than that. In terms of her personal wealth, she's around, her net worth is approximately around $1 million. They report their wealth in ranges, so it's kind of difficult to pinpoint exactly, and that doesn't include her mortgage. But in past campaigns, she hasn't given any of her own money, and I'm not sure if that's something she would be willing to do.
Okay, so let's turn now to industries. We've previously talked about like Cory Booker with pharma and Wall Street and all of that. When it comes to Amy Klobuchar, historically, have there been standout industries that have been particularly supportive of her runs?
Yeah, so none as, I don't know if they're as controversial as what we were talking about with Cory Booker. She's really, really popular with lawyers and law firms, given that she was one in the past. Like one of her former law firms is one of her most popular donors. So that's interesting in terms of its PAC and its employees. She's also really popular with women's issues groups, such as groups like Emily's List, that sort of thing. She did get quite a bit of money from Wall Street, so that's similar to Cory Booker. And she's also very popular with leadership PACs. So other PACs of other lawmakers have given her quite a bit over time.
Okay, so what about small donors? How does she compare to the rest of the field in her ability to generate smaller donations from regular people?
Yeah, so her last campaign, she got about a quarter of her funds from small donors. The Wall Street Journal did a really interesting analysis that was looking at the number of donations, and she's very far at the bottom of that. You have like Bernie Sanders up top and Beto. They have like millions of small donors, while Klobuchar was kind of at the bottom with like, I think it's 38,000, something very low. So it'll be interesting to see if she can kind of increase that support going forward or if she's kind of too far behind in that sense.
Yeah, and I guess it's possible. I mean, you know, Bernie had previously run for president, and Beto, his Senate race took on sort of national implications. Yeah, she doesn't come into this race necessarily with the sort of name recognition they have, but we do know that the DNC wants small donors to be an important sort of qualifying characteristic for getting on the debate stage. It'll be interesting to see if she's able to generate the sort of numbers that will allow her to end up, you know, with some of the other the big dogs, I guess, in this race. Okay, so fundraising strategy. We know that a number of different candidates have said they're not going to be accepting corporate PAC contributions. Where does she stand in terms of how restrictive she will be on how she fundraises?
So she did say that she wasn't going to take corporate PAC money like a lot of the other big ones. She also did talk about campaign finance reform quite a bit in her announcement. So she kind of railed against Citizens United, the Supreme Court case that kind of started super PACs and corporate donations to outside groups. So she's kind of taken a stand there and talked about how she wants to get rid of dark money, so undisclosed donations in politics. So that's kind of been a thing that she is putting at the forefront of her campaign.
So I'm glad that you went into that. Has she talked about any sort of like more radical revamping of campaign finance law? Does she express an interest in eliminating, you know, personal financing of campaigns?
She talked about a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United, which is quite bold. So that really stood out to me.
Okay. Well, that's certainly something. Well, thank you for doing the digging that you did. I wish that we had a little bit more that we could say about the industries, but apparently she has not necessarily drawn significant fossil fuel or pharma or anything like that. It seems like, as with a lot of her stances on the big issues, she's a little bit of a mystery at this point, unfortunately. But we do appreciate you breaking down everything that is available.
Yeah, one thing I did want to add that I did find interesting is, so there was an analysis put out from a local Minnesota paper that was showing that a lot of CEOs of Minnesota-based businesses are really fond of her. I think 11 out of 25 of the major company CEOs gave to her. And a couple of them are normally Republican donors. So I think that really says something. You know how there are a lot of polls out there saying that she's kind of likable with both parties. And this is kind of an interesting look at that, like even Republican donors are giving her money. So it kind of shows that she can maybe go across the aisle in ways that others may not be able to.
I don't know. That is interesting because liked by both parties, I know what that normally means in practice. And it usually does have business connotations. So thank you for the last bit as well.
Sure.
Ashley Balcerzak, federal politics reporter for the Center for Public Integrity. We always appreciate your work. Thanks again.
Thanks for having.
We're going to take one last break. We come back, we're going to take a tour around the world news you might have missed otherwise after this. Now let's take a tour of world news in a segment we like to call Meanwhile In. Meanwhile, in that bowl of pasta, Donald Trump has been declared the new God Emperor of Mankind. This one goes out to all the Warhammer 40K fans, but let's take a look at this video of a gigantic statue of Donald Trump in the garb of effectively a sci-fi psychic eternal ruler with a Twitter sword, by the way. And you see a bunch of people, I think they're space marines, marching in front of him in Italy. So what is the purpose of that awesome statue that I hope is never taken down? Fabrizio Galli, who created the float, said in an interview that the sword he's wielding contains the phrase meaning, here's your effing tariffs. So in the same way that the actual God Emperor of Mankind has an invincible army of eternal space marines with which to conquer the Xeno hordes, he has Twitter that he uses to impose his will on the world. And Galli goes on to say it's a joke, but in fact, he's trying to destroy nations with the economy instead of nuclear missiles. This is one of the strongest actions, let's say, that powerful people like Trump can use. I did not think that I would ever be talking about tabletop war games on this show, but I'm glad to. And I'm also glad that artists like Fabrizio Galli are using pop culture to draw attention to the way that Donald Trump exerts his will around the world and some of the negative international consequences of it. Meanwhile, in... Meanwhile, in Japan, The Olympic and Paralympic medals for the 2020 Olympics are going to be made out of recycled waste, which is an awesome move, I think. A project was started back in 2017 to collect enough electronic waste, including old smartphones and laptops, to implement the scheme. The aim was to collect more than 30 kilograms of gold, 4,100 kilograms of silver, and 2,700 kilograms of bronze, which is a reminder to me of exactly how many medals they end up giving out at these things. It is actually a gigantic task to try to do that, but they've been quite successful so far. The target for bronze was met last June, while the organizers had more than 90% of the gold and 85% of the silver by October. The recycled metal has been collected from the Japanese public, as well as businesses and industry. And it serves as a reminder, not just that there are going to be some awesome Olympics coming up in just a couple of years, but that we have an incredible amount of waste. And the waste is not necessarily 100% waste. There are things, especially in our electronics, that we do kind of need and could theoretically run out of. And so really stringent, advanced recycling programs can be very beneficial, not just in terms of reducing the sheer quantity of waste collecting in landfills, but in helping to achieve goals, whether artistic or sports or technological or otherwise. Meanwhile, in Russia, a state of emergency has been declared due to an invasion of bears, which is news not just for Earth, but also for my worst nightmares. Yes, the aggressive bears have entered homes and public buildings in the remote Novaya Zemlya, there's no chance I pronounced that correctly, archipelago, home to around 3,000 people, where officials have warned of a mass invasion. We are talking about dozens and dozens of bears. And let me remind you, this is a species where one in your town is kind of a big deal. And so when they start coming in squads and platoons, I start to get worried for the people. Let's put up a couple of photos. They've seen them inside of buildings. And you can see there, it's a little bit hard because, you know, it's low res, but that one is smiling. You know why he's smiling? Because he's going to get to kill people soon. If we go back to the first one, take a look at his dead eyes. Look at the sheer evil reflected in that polar bear's eyes. No, of course, polar bears are a beautiful species that have been victimized not just by human-caused climate change, which is one of the reasons why in cases like this, they're forced to flee into new areas to find food. But they've been hunted down historically in huge numbers, shot by tourists that are in areas that they should have never been. They suffer from a number of different problems, and now they're a problem for us. So, if you were not concerned about climate change for the many reasons we've previously listed on this show, how about an army of polar bears? Does that get you thinking about a Green New Deal? Meanwhile, hold off on the UK. I gotta give Craig credit. It's a bear van and it's coming. But meanwhile, in the UK, actual progress is being made on emissions reductions. Good news on the climate change. We never get to do that here at TDR. The finalized official statistics from the UK show that Britain's greenhouse gas emissions in 2017 were 2.7% lower than the year prior and 42.1% lower than back in 1990. Coal use for electricity fell 27% to a record low following the closure of two major plants. Hold that in your mind for 1 second. Additionally, the UK has a target of cutting CO2 emissions 80% by the middle of the century. Ministers are on track to meet their short-term goals, but the Advisory Committee on Climate Change says they are still short of policies to achieve long-term targets. Well, hopefully some of the new dynamic members of Congress here in the US can give them a few ideas on how they might do that. But I do want to give them credit. Coal use for electricity fell. Why? It's not shocking. It's because they shut down some of the coal plants and replaced it with other electricity generation. So while the UK is doing that, here in the US, Donald Trump is advocating, for I believe it's in Tennessee, to not shut down coal plants they're considering shutting down. And did you know that the people that manage those coal plants have given money to Donald Trump in his reelection efforts? Shocking news, I know. So there's an idea of we can move in the right direction, or we can be beholden to the corrupting influence of money in politics, generalized political corruption, and all of that. I just want to say very briefly, those of you who've been doing reviews on iTunes, thank you so much for doing that. Love this show. Put a message I'm going to read just to make Brett hate me. It says, love this show, love how John reports, and he's nice to look at too. Winky face. So thank you, Von Dutch 616. Very nice of you. iPatel 23 says, John Adirola is my spirit podcaster. That's awesome. And I really appreciate it. I'll read Danzig. I'll read yours tomorrow. Thank you so much to everybody who reviews it. It really helps us get the message out and have it exposed to new people. It's so necessary. Also, if you haven't gone to facebook.com/thedamagereportTYT, you should totally do that. We post not only the actual videos, but more content, behind the scenes stuff, all of that. So hope to see you there. Thank you everybody for watching. We'll be back tomorrow with Jared Jackson. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.